J1, number 19B.
And so we can have such ideal ideas being focused on, like the ideal intelligence, ideal order, ideal identity, ideal relationship, ideal life, ideal health, and ideal plan. Now, we say, okay, let's say that there's an ideal idea of health that is seen in the world today. Will that meet my need? I mean, maybe this ideal idea of health is going to go and it won't meet the need of myself or other people. And we say, no, that this ideal idea of health that is seen is going to diversify itself and be specified just through the laws of truth, as we'll see as we go on. But it appears as an ideal healthy mentality, or that new idea of health appears as ideal health in enfoldment, or ideal health in body, or ideal health in government, or an ideal health in our mode of life, or ideal health in consciousness, or an ideal health in affection. It's going to appear and meet the need in all these various avenues. Or we say, can this even be further diversified? And we can still just focus in on health and see, well, if there's an ideal health in consciousness, then we can say, well, this ideal healthy consciousness of mine then is going to help. I'm going to be able then to have an ideal healthy consciousness in guidance, in the work of, if I work in guidance or my guiding of my family, or any relationship. And this ideal healthy conscious of mine is going to be working in reflection of every relationship that I have. My ideal healthy consciousness is working. And then my ideal healthy consciousness is working for my own selfhood, for the benefit of myself. And then this idea of health, or my ideal healthy consciousness, is working in science of my government, of myself, and the science of government for everyone. An ideal healthy consciousness is working in my business, and my ideal healthy consciousness then is working for my family, and that my ideal healthy consciousness then can go out and bless the nation. But we see, just taking this ideal of health, it can diversify itself and specify itself in many ways. And just turn to the next illustrative material, and we can see that we can then not only focus in on health, but on order. I mean, ideal order. Ideal order always appears in a diversified and specified way. So we can have ideal ordered mentality, an ideal ordered unfoldment, an ideal ordered body, an ideal ordered government, an ideal ordered mode of life, an ideal ordered consciousness, an ideal ordered affection. And this diversifies and specifies itself more. So I can have ideal ordered unfoldment. We just go through unfoldment. And I can have that in guidance again, and I can have ideal ordered enfoldment in all the reflection, and I can have ideal ordered enfoldment in selfhood, ideal ordered enfoldment in the science of government, ideal ordered enfoldment in my business, ideal ordered enfoldment in family, and ideal ordered enfoldment in nation. You see, these ideas, each one of them just keep diversifying themselves, and the main point is that they always come to meet a specific need. They just are not out somewhere. And to have these sheets of paper, the more we ponder them, the more it builds up a certainty of just what life is and how really planned and ordered life is. Now we go on, and we come then to sun. And we know that life is the Father, truth is the Son, and love the Mother. And while studying life, we saw that life as Father means that the one mind, our mind as life, is self-existent. This means, of course, it exists out of itself. And then the one mind, our mind as life, is self-creating. It creates out of itself. It draws out of itself. And the one mind, our mind as life, is self-sustaining. And together we realized how really powerful it is to realize that our mind is self-sustaining. Therefore, it needs nothing to be added to it. It can't exhaust itself. So therefore, we are not sustained by blood and food and things like this. But it's self-sustaining. Mind sustains itself. And we realize that once the world sees the importance that mind is self-sustained, then that the world will take on a whole new life experience. Our whole experience will change because we've seen that all we are is maintenance men. We must sustain ourselves, sustain our house, sustain our cars, etc. But once we see that mind is self-sustaining, it takes away our whole life, which is as a maintenance man, and our whole experience will be totally different. It will open up new avenues. It's really quite a profound thing to see. So, therefore, life, as life, it's self-existing, self-creating, and self-sustaining. But as truth, our mind as truth, and as the sun, is self-expressing and self-affirming and self-asserting and self-claiming. Now just what does this mean? So we must look a little closer at this term sun. And in worldly terms, we know that sun always means the heir. It means the sun always takes possession of his inheritance. The sun always claims his inheritance. The sun sets himself in his father's place. So in science, we say that truth as sun, or the one mind, our mind as truth, or as the sun, is taking possession of itself. It's, in other words, self-expressing itself, self-affirming itself, self-claiming itself, self-asserting itself. But we say, what is it self-expressing? What is it affirming? What is it claiming? And we say it's affirming and acclaiming its own life, its own existence, its own self-creativeness. As truth, we're always claiming what we just are as life, you see. We're affirming it. We're claiming it. We're expressing it. Now, we see this a little more when we go on to our illustrative material, and just turn then to our illustrative material entitled The Laws of Truth. And we can help gain a deeper understanding of just what the term sun means as truth. And here these laws of truth, we have laws of truth now as we have laws of life. But the laws of truth are this, they're the law of truth itself, the law of self-affirmation, the law of self-realization, the law of self-demonstration, the law of self-application, the law of self-revelation, and the law of self-realization of divine consciousness, and the law of self-translation and retranslation. Now let's look at these laws. Now, the one of the law of truth itself. If life, as life we have seen, if our one mind, as life, if it's self-existing and self-creating and self-sustaining, then as truth we see that this self-existing, self-sustaining mind is the truth itself. It's just truth itself. And at this point we see that all the laws of life, all the laws of multiplication, instantaneousness, immediateness, and so forth, that these laws of life are here at this point of the law of truth itself being self-affirmed, self-realized, self-demonstrated, and self-applied. So we go on then and see the law of self-affirmation. And this just means that the one mind, or our mind as truth, affirms itself through its own inherent law of self-affirmation. It affirms, asserts, and establishes that its own self-creative existence is the truth under all circumstances. Or we see this, the law of self-realization. And here we again look at life, where we saw that the one mind, or our mind, multiplies itself, meaning that it's multiplying its ideas spontaneously, instantaneously, and immediately, restructuring themselves. So we have the appearing of new ideas. But here at Truth, we see that our mind realizes itself. through its own inherent law of self-realization, meaning that these new ideas which are being brought forth in life, these new ideas are now infinitely individualized or realized as specific ideas or specific ideal ideas which meet a specific situation, that these ideas are not randomly scattered everywhere. So as we've seen, that if in the world today an idea comes out about correct government, then this isn't going to be lost. It's not going to be applied to just correct government in our national affairs. But if we discover in the world what real correct government is, this is going to diversify itself and touch everyone. It's going to touch everyone's life. It's going to touch everyone's business, everyone's family, everyone's neighbors, the whole nation, you see. One can't have a new idea in the world until it touches every aspect of life, because life takes that, it diversifies it, classifies it, and individualizes itself, it specifies itself to a specific situation. So one never feels that we are going to be on the short end of any new discoveries or anything. Somehow it will show itself in our life. So we go on then to this law of self-demonstration. And we say then that the one mind, our mind as truth, demonstrates itself through its own inherent laws of self-demonstration. And to demonstrate means to prove to be certain, to prove or make manifest by tangible evidence and practical application. So when we were studying principle, we saw that our mind demonstrates itself. This was the fundamental fact that we saw while studying principle. But here we ask, how does it demonstrate itself? And so as life, it demonstrates itself as a spontaneous appearing of new ideas. And as truth, it demonstrates itself as taking those new ideas and infinitely individualizing them as specific ideas to meet every situation. So we have then the appearing of tangible evidence for a specific need. Then we go on to the law of self-application. And we can then flow through this the sense of the law of self-realization, self-demonstration, and application. They just flow, because we see through the law of self-realization that every idea meets a specific need in a specific situation. Through the law of self-demonstration, we see then that our mind is and ideas are being demonstrated, because they are meeting a specific need, then we're getting tangible evidence because the need is being met, so it's being demonstrated. And then we can see, because of the law of self-realization and the law of self-demonstration, that our one mind applies itself, means it adapts itself for a specific use, for a specific situation. And this is just the meaning of applying. When you look in Webster, to apply means to use for a particular purpose or a particular case. So through the laws of self-realization and self-demonstration, we see that our one mind is applying itself for a specific use and for a specific purpose. Then we have the law of self-revelation. And revelation in the dictionary means this. Revelation means, and I quote from Webster, the act of disclosing or discovering to others what has before been unknown to them. Appropriately, the disclosure or communication of truth to men by God himself or by his authorized agents, the apostles or prophets. Reveal means, to Webster then, to disclose or to make known from heaven. So revelation is always direct knowledge from heaven, or it's direct knowledge from the divine mind. It's not knowledge gained through accretion or by adding on. Revelation, it comes directly, not through a step-by-step process. So we say then that the one mind, our mind, as truth, reveals itself through its own inherent laws of self-revelation. So we see now, how can this be? Why? Why can it do this? And it's logical. If the one mind, or our mind as life, is constantly multiplying ideas spontaneously, instantaneously, and immediately, then as truth, we see that these new ideas appear suddenly. They appear spontaneously and immediately, and they appear as sudden revelations and sudden insights into solving a problem in our lives or solving a problem in our research. And we begin to see that more and more scientists speak about how knowledge came to them suddenly, through direct insight, through direct revelation. And more that the scientists go in and they ask various scientists how they discovered their ideas, the more and more they're beginning to see that these ideas are coming through direct revelation. Sudden insight. You see, they really are tuned in to this law of self-revelation. It's what's really happening to them. It's not so much they see they're adding on of knowledge. But you know, one cultivates one consciousness in knowledge and understanding, so you're just open. So all of a sudden, bang, an idea can come to you. Because your consciousness is so cultivated that it's open for direct revelation in the spontaneous impulse of new ideas into our consciousness. Then we go on and we see that there's a law of self-realization of divine consciousness. This just means that the one mind, our mind as truth, is conscious of itself. It's conscious of its many ideas. We're conscious of all ideas and the many laws. It also is a law which means that all ideas are conscious of being the one mind. All mind's ideas are conscious of their true identity, and all mind's ideas are conscious of each other. So, we can say this too. If our mind as truth is conscious of itself, then we see that it can affirm itself, it can realize itself, it can demonstrate itself, it can apply itself, and it can reveal itself. In looking at all these laws of truth, we see that they're multidimensional laws and that they just show the law of translatability, just as we saw with the laws of life. The law of truth itself, where our mind is seen as being truth itself and real, this law of truth itself is just translated as the law of self-affirmation, self-realization, self-demonstration, self-application, and self-revelation, or the self-realization of divine consciousness. That's a translated form of the law of truth itself. And it just shows that our mind establishes its ideas to be the truth in all circumstances. Now, all of these laws then are translated in overformed as a law of self-translation and retranslation. This just means that because our mind our ideas can be established as the truth in all situations, then this truth causes error to disappear. Through the translation of ideas to a specific case, this causes the retranslation of error out of itself. It causes a disappearance of error. And we will look a little closer at this law of translation and retranslation as we go on with truth. We come now to Christ. Now, Christ is a biblical expression, as we know, which means truth or divine consciousness. But in order for us to delve deeply into Christ, I'd first like to go on with the subject of consciousness, because consciousness actually is the root connotation of the word Christ, or divine consciousness. So let's just go on with the question of consciousness first, and then we'll come back to Christ. Consciousness as a noun, we see, means the state of awareness. It means a knowledge or awareness of something, as aware of one's own existence, or sensation and thought, or aware of one's own environment, or other people's sensations or thoughts. Consciousness also means the totality of attitudes and opinions, or it means the totality of experience at any given moment. So we say that our mind as truth is divine consciousness. And we say, well then, what is divine consciousness? And this is something that's very fundamental. We know it. We know that within the one being there are various degrees of awareness, and we know then that that first degree of mortal mind is just a material consciousness, which is based on mortal mind, matter, bodies, personal egos, which experiences death, sickness, and fear. It's just a consciousness filled of evil beliefs and deceit and hatred and so forth. And then the second degree we know is the human mind or human consciousness. But here, even at this second degree, Carl Jung has shown that the human mind, as we know, is based on the collective unconscious or on ancient mythological beliefs. And those ancient archetypal beliefs are just first-degree beliefs. And they are the irrational data which forms the matrices of all our thoughts. And then we know, too, that this human consciousness, though, is a transition stage between the first degree and the third degree. And it's a point where all these mythological beliefs are beginning to disappear, and one takes on more of the moral qualities of humanity and honesty and meekness and faith and so forth. And then the third degree we know is the divine mind or the divine consciousness, a consciousness which is based on the understanding of the seven synonymous terms. It's an understanding just filled, a consciousness just filled with all the ideas of the synonymous terms, ideas such as wisdom and purity and spiritual understanding and so forth. And in this third degree of consciousness, we know that all material consciousness and human consciousness disappears. So this realm of the third degree or the divine consciousness is that which is symbolized by the biblical term Christ. So let's go on to Christ. And we say now, what does Christ mean? Well, Christ itself comes from the Greek Christos, meaning the anointed one, which the American Heritage Dictionary states. Or the Hastings Dictionary states the meaning of Christos as appointed or empowered by God through the impartation of his Spirit. That's from the Greek meaning. Then we have Christ from the Aramaic meaning of Messiah. Messiah, which also means the anointed. So really, Christ and Messiah mean the same thing, the anointed one. It's just two different languages. So we know then that Christ is a divine title. It's a divine title which is given to an anointed one or to one who has a divine consciousness. Christ is also a divine office, or the office of the power of dynamic manifestation. Christ is then, we know, a state of consciousness. So Jesus, or the biblical Jesus, was a man, as any man who is just named Jesus, and we know that Jesus is a proper name given to any man, and that actually the Greek form of Jesus comes from Joshua, meaning the help of Jehovah or Savior. Now the biblical Jesus had divine consciousness, so he was called Christ Jesus or Jesus Christ. But we know that the title of Christ and the name Jesus are not synonymous, that the title of Christ can go to anyone who has divine consciousness. So we can all call ourselves the Christ. We can all identify with the Christ. And this is why Jesus said, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that believeth on me, the works that I do, he shall do also." He saw that we were entitled to also do the same works as he did, because he knew that we also had or could attain the Christ consciousness. And then in Hebrews we read, "For he," meaning Jesus, "is not ashamed to call them brethren." Therefore Jesus looked upon everyone as being equal. And in Paul states that, "But we have the mind of Christ," and he says, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus." And then too, we know that Christ is an eternal fact. Jesus said, "Before Abraham was, I am." meaning that Jesus identified himself with the eternal fact of divine consciousness. He didn't identify himself with the first degree of material consciousness, but he saw that this Christ consciousness always was eternally before Abraham was I am. And we also know that this Christ is an eternal fact which is independent of Jesus' life. Because Hebrews says, the same yesterday and today and forever. We know that Christ is not an idea which began with Jesus or ends with Jesus. It's an eternal fact. Or Mary Baker Eddy would say that Abraham, Jacob, Moses, and the prophets caught glorious glimpses of the Messiah or Christ, which baptized these seers in the divine nature, the essence of love. So those thinkers who lived or who were written about before the time of Jesus were shown as catching glimpses of the Christ. So the Christ, you see, is an eternal fact. And Paul, we know, on his way to Damascus, took hold of the Christ consciousness. And this was about 6 years after Jesus' ascending. And then we know that St. John, about 60 or 70 years after Jesus' ascension, took hold of the Christ consciousness and wrote Revelation. But here's an interesting question that we can ask. It's an open question. We can say, if anyone who has a divine consciousness can be called the Christ, then why didn't Abraham call himself Christ Abraham? Or we can say, if the prophets were always talking about the Christ, then why wasn't Hosea claiming the Christ and saying, calling himself Christ Hosea, or Christ Joel, or Christ Amos? And the answer to this is that no one in the Old Testament claimed the Christhood, or claimed the Christ for himself. That, Mrs. Eddy said, they caught glorious glimpses of the Christ. A consciousness, but they were always waiting for the future. They didn't believe that you could have total divine consciousness here and now, or that they believed that somebody outside of them would come as a Messiah with divine consciousness and save them. But you see, it wasn't until the New Testament or Jesus who actually claimed he was the Christ. He claimed he had divine awareness here and now. He made himself the Son of God and the heir of God. And he saw that the Christ was an ever-present fact for him to grasp hold of. And Jesus said that all that have ever come before me are thieves and robbers. Now that's quite a powerful statement, and he said that about the prophets. He said that the prophets were thieves and robbers because they stole their own Christhood, because they were robbing themselves of their Christhood, because they didn't believe that they could have total Christ consciousness here and now, or that they were looking for somebody outside of themselves to gain salvation. They were looking for another Messiah. But you see, it was Jesus at this point that's unique, because he took possession of the Christ. He took possession of the third degree of divine consciousness. He claimed he was the Son of God and heir of God. He claimed that he was all God was. He claimed all that mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love stand for. He claimed he had the mind of Christ. He didn't have to look out of himself. He had the mind of Christ here and now. He didn't have to look to the future. And he claimed that everyone had the mind of Christ, because he said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. And he said that everyone had the mind of Christ here and now, because he said, behold, the fields are already white with harvest. So what we must say to ourselves is that we are not going to be thieves and robbers. We're not going to steal our Christhood. We're not going to wait for the future to bring us divine awareness. And we're not going to look for somebody outside of ourselves to come with the Christ consciousness and save us. And I think that the teaching of Christian Science is unique, as we'll see in its scientific aspect. Of course, many of the mystics teach the infinite one and being one with the infinite one. Science explains the infinite categories of this infinite one. But we must claim our Christhood. We must not be thieves then or robbers. This is just something that we are cultivating and we know more or less now as being a fact. But this isn't something everybody knows. It's something we begin to take as for granted almost. And other people and other religions are waiting now for the second appearing of Jesus to come, when he's going to come.